Have you heard? Sling TV offers the news you love for less.
Hey, wait, you look and sound just like me.
I am you. I'm the same news programs on Sling TV for less.
You mean you're me, but for less money?
A lot less. I'm all the favorite news programs and more on Sling TV, starting at just $40 a month.
Everything great about me, but for less money?
Which makes me greater, don't you think?
Get the news you love and more for less.
Start saving today. Visit Sling.com to see your offer.
Sling.
With the Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. From the award-winning author of True Crow Sorrow comes another historical true crime story about secret identities, deception, and murder. At the turn of the century, an ex-convict from Ireland arrives in the backcountry of rural Nova Scotia, whereupon he is accused of murdering a man and burying him in the victim's own cellar under a pile of potatoes. Rooted in Deception follows the life of John Kavanagh and how this petty criminal deceives everyone in his path, until he is eventually accused of a heinous and violent murder for which he is ultimately hanged. But how much of the tragedy was of his own doing and how much had been woven by his enemies? Told from a variety of perspectives, including that of the accused, the book creates a sympathetic case for a man who may deserve none. Using primary sources including newspaper articles, trial transcripts, and actual letters from the accused, the true story of the murder of Freeman Harvey is told using creative nonfiction devices to fill in the gaps of the narrative. Rooted in Deception follows True Crow Sorrow, which was awarded the 2020 Bronze Award for Best Creative Nonfiction by the Miramichi Reader. The book that we're featuring this evening is Rooted in Deception, with my special guests, journalist and author, Laura Churchill Duke. Welcome to the program, and thank you for this interview, Laura Churchill Duke.
Hi, thank you so much, Dan, for having me.
Thank you so much. Congratulations on this fascinating, fascinating book. Let's talk about how you came to be the author, how you first heard about this story. Give us some of the details on the background of how you came to be the author of Rooted in Deception.
Sure, that's great. So I, as you mentioned, I live in rural Nova Scotia in Canada here, and I was taking part one evening in something called Valley Ghost Walks. So these are historical walks that we have throughout our region where people go around and basically characters from the past are brought back to life to share their stories. That's all done through something called Valley Ghost Walks. And I was participating in one of these walks in the evening, and I heard this story about the murder of Freeman Harvey. And the story, it's so peculiar and odd that it stuck in my mind. Something really interesting that I might like to learn more about. As you mentioned, I do have another novel that I had finished writing. It was called Two Crows Sorrow. And that was also a true crime murder that happened in 1904, also here in the Annapolis Valley of Nova Scotia. And after having written that and really caught the research bug, I had begun thinking about what could I possibly research and write about next. And I am a true crime junkie. So that is when this story, the murder of Freeman Harvey, came to mind, and I really wanted to research it some more.
You say that when you started your research, and we'll talk about how you do start that research, you knew two things. What were the two things that you knew only about this case?
Yeah, so we knew that Freeman Harvey had been murdered, and we knew that the convicted murderer was a man that they were calling George Stanley Kavanaugh. What we knew was that he was really a con man and a trickster. So basically what we knew, we weren't sure if we really knew it, but based on newspaper reports and some of the trial transcripts at the time, the two facts that I did know is that he came from a small town in Ireland, and I also knew approximately when he was born and approximately some of the names that this con man had used, and that was all I had to go on.
Now, you talk about the person that was responsible for helping you out and the organization that was also instrumental in helping you. Tell us about that instrumental help.
Yeah. So to me, almost this kind of backstory is what is most exciting about putting this whole novel together is that, as I said, I knew that convicted murderer, he was from a small town called Roscrea in Ireland. And so I actually, just on a whim, I sent an email to the Historical Society there. And I said, I have this guy, his name could be this, this, or this, and I believe he's from your town. What can you help me with? And then that started a relationship with Pamela Aitken of the Roscrea Heritage Society there in Ireland. And she and another fellow historian, they started rooting through records. And it was just so exciting because they actually found this man in all their town records. So I have his birth certificate, I have his school records, I have his church records, I have his parents' marriage certificate. She even went and showed me the house where he actually lived in Roscrea as well. So we do know his real name was John Kavanaugh from Roscrea. So that was the exciting part, is forming this relationship with the Historical Society there.
Very interesting. You write Liverpool, England, December 4th, 1905. John Kavanaugh is dead. So you say the new John is at this Albert Docks in Liverpool. Tell us what's happening and who he is assuming an identity of.
Yeah, so that's you've just read there, Dan, is the opening line of the story rooted in deception. And it's kind of this point, it's kind of a crux in John Kavanaugh's life, where he has spent much time in Ireland, most of his life actually in the prison system there. And he is out on what we call kind of bail or probation. And he decides at that point of time to go to England. And from the Liverpool docks, he leaves there and he journeys over to Nova Scotia on the ship register. I have that as well. When he comes over, he actually uses the name John Ryan. So at that point, he's creating another identity to start his life all over again in Nova Scotia. So he does leave through Liverpool, England, arrives in Halifax, Nova Scotia here, where he is involved in many a con here in Halifax before he makes his way down further into rural Nova Scotia, where he assumes yet another name and another identity and becomes involved in this murder case.
Let's talk about right from the very beginning. He uses this alias John Ryan, but it's very interesting, as you write, that immediately he meets someone named Thomas Forsey, and he's very gregarious, this John Ryan. And he tells a story of where he has come from, and he befriends this person. And this person says, well, I just happen to be, my wife's running a boarding house. And he told, again, just this beginning of the myriad of lies that this person tells. He says he's a tailor by trade. And he says, well, I mean, there's this big employer in town, Clayton and Sons, is your best bet. Now, and he also tells him about a rich uncle that he has, and he's about to send him some money. So tell us more about this Thomas Forsey and just the kind of characteristic methodology that this John Ryan uses to ingratiate himself into the community.
Yeah, so this is kind of a pivotal moment for John, well, our John Kavanaugh's. When he comes over, he meets this man, Thomas Forsey, as you said, on the ship. And it's kind of this moment where everything clicks together. As I mentioned before, John Kavanaugh, he is a notorious con man and a thief, and he's just I picture him as this wonderful, gregarious, outgoing man. You have to be, if you're going to be a con man and you want to pull people into your deception, you need to be likable. People need to believe you and they want to believe you. And of course, we're a very trusting society here too. So that also helps. And he really did meet this man named Thomas Forsey on the ship, who he and his wife did own a boarding house. So that was very pivotal moment, because from then John did come to Halifax, lived with Thomas and his wife Jessie for a while, and gets involved in some scams right there, stealing from the people with whom he is staying. The police are involved. So it is just from that moment, it's like John Kavanagh almost has this compulsion. He's unable to stop and really form a real relationship with anybody. He's telling lies right from the get-go. He's got a rich uncle. He's got a sister who's coming to move with him. Of course, reading in hindsight, you can see, well, you shouldn't believe anything he said, but you can also see how people, especially at the time, are so trusting and just taken in by this charismatic Irish man who's only about 5'2", 5'3". I picture him as just this lovely gentleman. My husband does say, my problem is I liked him too much.
Yeah.
But he is a very interesting character.
It's interesting right away. You tell that he is caught and suspected of stealing at this boarding house. And of course, they notify the police about their suspicions and want him arrested. The police dilly-dally and say, well, tomorrow will be soon enough. And sure enough, this John Ryan is gone in the wind, isn't he?
Yes, that's absolutely right. And there's a lot of research done too in Nova Scotia too, of just about that police chief himself, who had a notoriously bad reputation as well for not really doing great police work. And this was a prime example of, had John Kavanagh been caught at that moment, everything that happens afterwards definitely would have been prevented.
You write that the only thing that he left behind was a pair of old boots, and they recognized the boots as the kinds of boots that convicts would wear. The next date that you have is January 16th. So soon after, you take us to Bedford, Nova Scotia, and John Ryan is in a hotel room and checked in as Mr. Doyle. Of course, his bill is to be paid. And of course, he's probably telling the same story about the rich uncle and the money coming anytime soon. Tell us what happens at this Bedford, Nova Scotia hotel room.
Right. So Bedford is just right outside of Halifax. So he's escaped from Halifax from boarding house. And he's gone to Bedford, which is really like a stone's throw away. So he's really not far away. And then, of course, point in time, the hotelier wants his money paid. And so John realizes, well, you don't have the money to pay. So he tells the man at the hotel, I'll get the money for you. And he leaves and again, takes off and never comes back. All of this information, as I say, what we're talking about here, all is the result information that later comes out in newspaper articles with all these people being interviewed as to what happened. So that's how we kind of are putting the sequence events all together. But you know, basically, he just takes off again, doesn't pay, and leaves Bedford to head towards more rural Nova Scotia.
Take us to January 26th, and there's another center called Eller House, Nova Scotia, and another hotel, Eller House Hotel. And this John Ryan, you say, comments, because he's a foreigner in the country, this is pure woodland. This is pure wilderness that this guy has found himself in, not knowing where exactly he's going.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is one of the key factors that I think is the reason that he decided to stay in Eller's House. I believe he took the train from Halifax into Eller's House. Driving, it takes maybe 45 minutes. And it really is, even to this day, it is still very woodland, really rural Nova Scotia. And I believe that is why John Kavanagh decided to stay in Eller's House, because it really, really, truly is in the middle of nowhere in the woods, which would make a very perfect place to hide and for him even just to regroup or figure out what he's going to do next. And so at this time, he assumes the name George Stanley, and that's really what he's called to and referred to in most of the trial information from there. He's known as George Stanley. But he then gets involved himself in another scam with the people of Eller's House and trying to get them to sign up to have telephones installed. This is the time, 1906, of course, where we're just starting to see those telephones happening. But what really interests me at this time is that although he may have a long list of people who want to sign up for his telephones, but he never collects money from anybody, which I find is very interesting. So he is doing a scam. He's ingratiating himself into the community, but yet he is not yet collecting money, but he's still making a name for himself.
You're right that he's talking to the hotel, Ellerhaus hotel owner, Charles Reich, and he tells him that he's from London and he's been here a couple weeks. And it also lied and told that others similar in business had signed up for his service as well with this Western Union telephone. But he also at that time is asking if there's any farms for sale. And then so this Charles Reich says, well, he did hear that old Mr. Harvey might be wanting to sell with his wife working in town. And he's left there most of the time by himself and getting on in age and he's maybe having a hard time with the farm. So that's what this George Stanley gets to hear at this Charles Reich's hotel. So he continues with this scam and talking to other people, but his interest has been piqued by the talk of old Mr. Harvey and his farm and some of the details that he has been given by this hotel owner.
That's right. And I think that's kind of what planted a seed saying, oh, okay, here's another venue, another option, another thing that I could try exploring. So the big question, of course, is does he really mean to purchase the farm, or is he just seeing this as really as an easy target, an older man living by himself? And so, of course, John Kavanaugh, he goes to the house to see the old man and he asks to make change or something like that. And he realizes that Freeman Harvey is the one responsible for collecting the school taxes. He actually went door to door and collected cash and he had it all in his house. So John Kavanaugh knows that this old man is in this house. He has lots of money available, easy target. He's alone. He's older. He's very, very deaf as well. So
now he's also asked, because he doesn't have a place to stay. And even the Mr. Harvey, old man Harvey, when he asked if he was interested in selling his farm, said, you don't really look like the kind of guy that has enough money. So he also says to the farmer or Mr. Harvey, he says, you know any cheap place in the area that I could stay while I'm waiting for this windfall of money? And so he suggests the Fisher family. Tell us about the Fisher family and are they willing to take in this George Stanley?
Yeah, the Fisher family, they become very involved with George Stanley, John Kavanaugh. I never quite know how to keep referring to him. I mean, they become very involved with him and they do have kind of like a boarding house sort of. And John ends up renting a room from them. Now, the Fisher family is, I would definitely call them like a product of the time period. So again, we're right at the turn of the century. This is a very, very, very poor family and illiterate, uneducated family, again, in the middle of nowhere. So those kind of are all the circumstances that are around that family kind of creating, leading to what's going to happen next. But as I say, they're uneducated. They have no idea. So they are very taken in by John Kavanaugh, who we've already said is like a charlatan. He's really gregarious. And they definitely, for lack of better words, they fall in love with him. He becomes a part of their family. And by all accounts in all the newspapers, all the trial transcripts, this family is really described as, for lack of better words, not the sharpest tools in the shed. So they really have no idea what is happening to them or around them, and especially when they welcome this character into their home. And their son, Jim, who's about 25-ish, John Ryan is about 40, they become fast friends. And John promises that the son, Jim, that he could have a job working with the telephone company. Then he also promises the Fisher family, well, you can live in Freeman Harvey's house once I buy it. I'm going to give you this farm and this house to take care of. So, of course, they're even more smitten with him because of that news as well.
You also talk that the matriarch of this family, the head of this family, is this Mary Ann, and you say inarticulate and uneducated and very, very, very gullible. Now, George Stanley goes to see Harvey, to see the farmer. What happens in this discussion? How does it come about? And with this person so hard of hearing, tell us about his coming to this farm and having discussion with this old man, Harvey.
Yeah. So this is the part two where, so Raymond Harvey does have a conversation with John Ryan about purchasing the farm. We do know that this happens, but as for really what really happens at that particular moment on everything kind of blows up, starts taking place on the Friday afternoon. We do know that John or George Stanley, he goes to visit old man Freeman Harvey to talk about the purchasing of the farm. As I mentioned before, was he really, really going to buy this farm? And if so, what was the money he was going to use to purchase the farm? Or was this just a ploy to get the money that he thought was in the house? So basically, John Kavanaugh, he does go there on the Friday afternoon. And then the Saturday morning, he goes back to the Fisher's house and he says, he waves some papers in the air and says, look, I have the deeds to the farm. You can now go and move into the farm. Freeman Harvey, he has gone to Halifax. He's gone to the city to work out the paperwork and do all the legal things for the selling of the farm. So he's not there. You come, you move in. And that's like the Saturday morning. And that kind of sets the whole thing for the scene for what happens over the weekend.
You talk about, though, that George Stanley borrows a knife, I believe, from one of the Fisher boys, David, I believe. And David says, well, what for? What do you need the knife? Well, I'm doing some business and I need the knife. He says, well, it's pretty dull. And he says, that's okay. He still borrows a knife, says, I need to do some business with this knife. I'll give it back to you. He gives that knife back the next day. What does this David note about that knife?
Yeah. So he borrows the jackknife. He goes down to see Freeman Harvey, comes back the next day, returns the knife. And all of a sudden, the knife is a lot sharper and a whole lot cleaner than when he first lent out the knife. So that was a little bit of a suspicion. I'm not sure David Fisher really would have picked up on all that information, but
right.
He does make note of it for sure.
Now, what is the George Stanley's mentions to people that are neighbors and he's looking for at that time to be able to sell some things that were on this farm that he now claims to own exclusively. Tell us who he approaches, who does he talk to, and then tell us about the loan skeptic.
Right. So after he claims that he has purchased the farm, he goes, as I say, he goes back to the Fishers and say, okay, you can move into the farm. The Fishers start to kind of prepare for that. So then because he says that he now owns the farm, John now decides that he is going to basically liquidate all the assets. There are some oxen, there's a horse. It's not a huge farm, but there's enough equipment there and there's some hay and other farming materials. So Jim Fisher then goes with John and they basically go around the community. And the way the society kind of worked then at that time, especially in rural areas, it wasn't so much selling things like we do on Facebook Marketplace or whatever. It's more, I'll trade you this, I'll barter, I trade you this for this, I'll give you this for that. So it was more rather than cash changing hands, it was a lot of trading and upselling. So John went to like one of the local butchers and he was able to trade in some of his oxen or he went to one of the members of legislature, one of the local politicians, he went to him and James Spence, he went to him, the local politician, and said, I'll give you this. And he upgraded some of the horses. And it's kind of one of these things, when I was writing it, I almost needed to have little diagrams to say what material was with whom at what time, who had what in their hands at what situation, because it was just kind of going back and forth around everybody. So again, we have James Spence, who is the local politician. We have his younger brother, George Spence, who also purchases some of the harnesses and things like that. And then we also have another character who comes in at this point in time, whose name is Edgar McCarthy. And according to the entire community, he's basically a bad apple. He has a bad reputation. He had been tried in court before for an assault for beating up a mailman. And so he gets involved in this situation. So after all of this trading is happening, both Edgar and George Spence, these two other gentlemen who are involved in the bartering, are kind of they step back for a moment and they think, whoa, what is happening here? Why is John trading all of these materials? Why is he selling off all of this stuff for such cheap prices? And at one point, Edgar says, this can't be really your stuff, because if it was your stuff, you wouldn't let be letting it go for this cheap of a price. So what's really happening here? So after about 12 hours of trading, the suspicions start to arise a little bit, and they start really confronting John about, hey, what is really happening and where is Freeman Harvey?
You're right that while they finally do get around to questioning him, and this McCarthy is very, very skeptical and confrontational as well, that there is a reason for this George Stanley to have David Fisher stay at the house while he conducts some business. But what we haven't spoken about is that there is this indication that once he had got this farm, that the back door was not to be used and accessed, instead go through the front door, because he said when they asked him why, he said, well, because that's old man Harvey's stuff and I don't want anybody going through and I don't want it disturbed. But at some point he goes even further and makes sure that it's locked so nobody can go back there. Tell us about these suspicions and skepticism and what that leads to.
Right. So exactly as you said, basically, John, he cuts off the whole back porch of the house. And he's like, don't go out there. Don't go out there. And he makes everybody use the front door. And then as you said, at one point, he gets a latch and like a padlock, and he makes them bolt the door. They're eating lunch, and Marianne Fisher, she comes up and she wants to make them lunch. And she's like, I'll go down to the root cellar. I'll get some potatoes and I'll make everybody lunch here. And John is like, no, I'll go down to the basement. I'll get the potatoes. So he does. He goes down, he grabs some potatoes. He comes back up that Marianne can use it. And that's when he really locks the door and he says, nobody's to go out there. Freeman Harvey's stuff is out there. Don't touch it. So again, then John, he leaves and he's not on the premises. But again, these folk who've been there all weekend are really getting suspicious. Like, why is this door locked? What is going on? Why is he so nervous about this back door? So again, at this point in time, John has basically disappeared. They're not really sure where he is. He's gone. Jim Fisher, the boy who he had been boarding with, he's gone as well. And the community members who are there at the house are just kind of lost and trying to figure out what is happening. So they get together and they decide, okay, we're going to break the lock. So they get an axe, they break open the lock, they break open the door, they head down into the root cellar, into the basement, which would have been like a dirt floor basement in this old house. And when they get, well, of course, they're arguing about who has to go first. They're all scared to go down to the basement. They're not sure what's down there. But when they do get down there, they do make a gruesome discovery in the basement.
Tell us what they find in the bundle, in the pile of potatoes.
Yeah, so right at the bottom, as I said, it's a cold storage. So, of course, where they would have kept all the vegetables, and there was a pile of potatoes, and there was some blood on the floor as well. And they were just kind of rooting through this crate of potatoes, and they find a foot. And following the foot through, they find the body.
For those who embrace the impossible, the Defender 110 is up for the adventure. This iconic vehicle has been redefined with a modern design that lets you go further and do more. The exterior is reimagined with compelling proportions and precise detailing, complemented by an interior built with integrity. The Defender capability is legendary. Whether you're facing off-road challenges or harsh weather conditions, its durability has been tested to the extreme. Powerful innovations like the intuitive driver display and award-winning infotainment system keep you connected. Innovative camera technologies deliver unobstructed views and effortless maneuvering. And robust cargo capacity means more room for your gear. Ready for a wide range of adventures, the Defender family features the two-door Defender 90, the Defender 110, and the Defender 130, which seats up to 8. To drive the Defender is to explore with greater confidence. Push what's possible with a vehicle made to go further. The Defender 110. Learn more at LandRoverUSA.com/Defender.
Have you heard? Sling TV offers the news you love for less.
Hey, wait. You look and sound just like me. I am you. I'm the same news programs on Sling TV for less.
You mean you're me, but for less money.
A lot less. I'm all the favorite news programs and more on Sling TV starting at just $40 a month.
Everything great about me, but for less money?
Which makes me greater, don't you think? Get the news you love and more for less.
Start saving today. Visit Sling.com to see your offer.
Sling. Collider says BritBox has TV everyone should be watching. Stream acclaimed series with powerful performances from Jodie Whittaker, Tamara Lawrence, Bella Ramsey, and Sophie Rundle. Discover new BritBox original series like Agatha Christie's Murder is Easy, BAFTA-winning drama Time, and new crime thriller After the Flood from the producers of Happy Valley. Stream what the New York Times calls the best of British telly. Only on BritBox. Start a free trial at BritBox.com.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Whether you're a morning person or a bedtime procrastinator, everyone deserves a mattress that works for their style. And you'll find the best mattress for you at Ashley. The new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley brings you one-of-a-kind body-conforming technology, making every sleep tailored to be your best. The collection also features cool-to-the-touch covers and motion absorption to help minimize sleep disruptions from partners, pets, or kids. Shop the all-new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley. For the love of home.
Of what they assume is Freeman Harvey in his own cellar, in his own pile of potatoes in the basement. And with the really gruesome details, his head has been decapitated. So this brings on a search to find the head. And eventually they do find Freeman Harvey's head in a bucket in another part of the cellar. So yeah, the body is there. It's in the basement, buried in the pile of potato, head decapitated. And John Kavanaugh and Jim Fisher are both gone and missing.
Very interesting too, is that this normally there would be some decomposition and disfigurement of the facial features. But in this particular case, because of the temperature in that cellar, his body had been preserved, and especially when they lifted that head and saw the actual face in its original condition.
And it had been less than 48 hours as well, too. So it was a very, very quick turnaround. And as you say, it was definitely cold and it was winter here. So meaning being extra cold.
Yes. Let's use this as an opportunity to stop for a second for these messages.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Now you have a character, Chief Samuel McDonald, and another constable that are on this, on the case. And they're also just looking for Jim Fisher and this George Stanley that are on the loose and in this very hard to search for in this dense woods.
That's right. So they know that they couldn't have gotten far because Jim and John have taken off by foot. And so they know they probably haven't gone far. So they really do rally the entire community, kind of comes together to try to figure out. There's a train line along there and there's people, over 100 people came out and were like along sections of the railway trying to look. And again, as I mentioned before, this is a very deep wood area. There's a lot of logging camps through there too, as well. And so they don't really know where to go. So as I say, the community is involved. They also get involved a tracker from the local native reserve as well. So a gentleman from there comes over and he does help track, and eventually in the deep woods does come across Jim Fisher and John Kavanaugh, who are in the woods there trying to hide out. Because the native gentleman was only by himself, he was only really able to arrest one of them, citizen's arrest, and that was Jim Fisher. And so he did take into captivity Jim Fisher, but at that point in time, John Kavanaugh did run off further into the woods and he got away.
You're right. At this time, at the same time, is that there is a couple, Benjamin Shaw is a noted journalist and he has a son named Russell, his protege, 19 years old. And there's a person from the Western Union Telephone Company, maybe a director, I believe, William McKee. And they team up to go to the Fishers and do some interviews. And they know, and Benjamin knows, Shaw knows a story when he hears it.
That's right. So this is, of course, the time period, although you could argue that this really hasn't changed very much today either, is that this is the time period where a salacious headline in a newspaper is definitely going to, is what's going to sell the newspapers. So they do come down to Eller's house, they take the train down, and they want to be the first there on the scene to get that story. So the person from the Western Union, because of course, John had said that he was working for them, so he came down to say, no, he's not working for us. And then also the newspaper reporter, Russell, they come down and they spend all this time with the Fisher family to try to get firsthand information about what happened and who this John Kavanagh, or George Stanley as they knew him, who he really was. And it's a very in-depth interview that they did. And it's through this interview we are able to learn so much about what happened and who everybody was and the background. But whether these interviews are really ethical or, you know, great style of journalism, that can be argued right. as well. But that's what happened.
What they did tell, police at that time, or pardon me, Russell Shaw and William McKee, was that this McCarthy was the guy they should really look at, and that he was a known criminal and really you should be looking at him. So they noted that as well. There is a person named Hibbert Chapman, and his sister was married to old man Harvey, his sister Ida. So he joins the search because he's very interested in capturing this guy as well. And so with Constable George Singer and Samuel McDonald that in charge of this case, they went to search and they spoke to a William Spence. And what did William Spence tell him in terms of the location of this George Stanley?
Yeah, so they did, as I mentioned, they did go through the backwoods into these logging camps. And one of those logging camps was owned by this man named William Spence, and who, their family and their descendants still own all these logging areas as well, which is really interesting too, I find. But yeah, so he went down there and they discovered John Ryan, George Stanley. He had just been there. He had had dinner at the logging camp. So they were able to say, oh, he went off in that direction, in that direction. So, but they also noted he's wearing his city clothes. It's the middle of winter. It's January, February in rural Nova Scotia. It's super cold. He's not dressed properly. So they're like, he's not going to get very far, but they were able to track him through the woods. And that's another reason this Hibbert Chapman, other than his sister being married to Freeman, he also knew these backwoods really, really well. So he was really essential in this case in doing the hunt to find and track down John there. And he does eventually, they do find him in the backwoods in the direction that guy from the logging camp had said that he had gone. So they were able to capture him at that point in time.
You're right that immediately this Chapman, Hibbert Chapman, asks him, why did you kill old man Harvey? And what is immediately and indicative of the kind of responses that will be continue, what does he have to say?
Yeah, well, he absolutely. He's like, he's not involved, right? It's not him. He's placing the blame on other people. It wasn't him. More people were more involved than him. He places the blame on the Fishers. He places the blame on Edgar McCarthy. Again, he uses his skills and attempts to talk his way out of the situation.
Despite him being a good liar and a good talker, what happens as a result? He's arrested. Tell us how police and even the media proceed.
Yeah, so he is arrested, John Ryan, John Kavanagh, he is arrested. And so are actually Dave Fisher and his son, Jim Fisher, the Fisher family. They're also arrested as well because John is saying, oh, the Fishers are involved. Fishers are involved as well. So all three of them are arrested. All three of them are charged with the murder. So then they're taken by train by the constables there, taken by train to Windsor, which is the next town, which is probably like maybe a 20-minute train ride, I would say, into the town where they are held in jail point in time. Now, very interestingly as well, the three of them are all held together in the same jail cell. So it also allows for what I believe allows John to plant some ideas, some seeds into the Fishers' heads about maybe really what happened or things that he wants the Fishers to say. That opportunity is there because they are not separated in the jail cell. So that's where they also, again, start blaming Edgar McCarthy as well for more of the murder as well.
What else does this George Stanley do while he's incarcerated? And then tell us about the processes to be able to finally take him, bring him to justice.
Yeah. So while he's in jail, as I say, he keeps trying to talk his way out of the situation. And is not being very successful. While he's there, he's also he's a prolific writer, and he writes tons of, I'd say probably close to 50, 75 letters. He hand writes letters trying to appeal, trying to get people in the community to help them come to his aid, the Irish societies, politicians. His writing is impeccable, beautiful penmanship, beautiful spelling, all of that. So it really proves that he was a very educated man to be able to write in such a way. I do have copies of all these letters too, which is fascinating. So yeah, he's writing letters in the jail while he's there. Eventually they go and they have the inquest trial where it is determined that the Fishers really were just pawns in George's master plan. And so they are released and the trial will now go forward where John is the only person being convicted and accused of this murder.
Tell us how this trial proceeds, some of the characters involved, and the media and public response.
Right. So what is it? Again, the trial takes place in this small town of Windsor at the courthouse there, and crowds from all around flock in, go to this trial. It is definitely a huge deal. Again, this is not a time where we had other forms of entertainment. We didn't have TV or social media, all those things, right? Yeah. So the people are flocking and really getting involved in this case. And so during the trial, we have a whole series of people who come forth to give the testimonies. We have the Fishers are all on trial there who come forth. And there's some great scenes in the book that are taken verbatim from the trial transcripts where they really don't understand what's happening. They get themselves very confused. Yes. And they come off as they are very, very uneducated. It's funny when you look at it now, but you do realize that, you know, these were people who are just product of their times as well. So many interesting characters coming forth. Edgar McCarthy is still put on the stand, and the defense is really trying to prove that, you know, it's possible that it was Edgar McCarthy who did it because he's this bad seed and he was there all weekend as well. So yeah, we have a whole slate of interesting characters at the trial, and the jury's trying to figure out what happened, what really did happen to Freeman Harvey.
Right from the onset, what is, and it seems to be surprising, certain people in the audience, maybe even the journalists themselves, what is this George Stanley's, John Kavanaugh's demeanor throughout?
Yeah, he's pretty quiet throughout the entire trial. He really doesn't say anything. And of course, that makes for a really uneventful trial when you are there to witness something that is so super exciting. And if he is not doing anything, that makes it really, really boring, especially in terms of in my first book, Two Crows Sorrow, where we have the convicted murderer who is actively shouting things out during the trial and is very demonstrative. This is a very different approach. And so they're all just carefully scrutinizing him too. Personally, I think John/George, he'd been through the trial system so many times in his previous life that I think that's just what his learned response was. But one of the interesting components too, as you were talking about the media as well, is that we really have a situation here. It's trial by newspaper, really trial by the media. The media would print these headlines, these outrageous news, not doing any fact checking, but just because it makes a really great story. And just to kind of really taint what the public image was about George Stanley. And then maybe a couple of days, they might make a little bit of a retraction of a statement saying, oh, well, I guess that wasn't really true what we printed. But by that time, the news is already out. So with the newspapers and the media, they really did turn public opinion against John. And that point in time as well, here in Canada, we had a lot of anti-Irish sentiment. So that was really playing out as well. So kind of all the media played that up too. So whether John had a fair trial or was fairly treated, it's really hard to say. And again, we can have the conversation is how much has changed today as well with our even social media headlines and the role of the media as well. But it's interesting.
He was an amazing, outgoing, well-spoken con man, and he was articulate and could converse well in letters. Did he take the stand? And why would he, if he didn't, why not?
No, he did not take the stand. And I think this was a really common practice at the time in Canadian law here, that they did not, witnesses did not take the stand. And he was not even, I don't even know if he was even asked to be able to.
For those who embrace the impossible, the Defender 110 is up for the adventure. This iconic vehicle has been redefined with a modern design that lets you go further and do more. The exterior is reimagined with compelling proportions and precise detailing, complemented by an interior built with integrity. The Defender capability is legendary. Whether you're facing off-road challenges or harsh weather conditions, its durability has been tested to the extreme. Powerful innovations like the intuitive driver display and award-winning infotainment system keep you connected. Innovative camera technologies deliver unobstructed views and effortless maneuvering. And robust cargo capacity means more room for your gear. Ready for a wide range of adventures, the Defender family features the two-door Defender 90, the Defender 110, and the Defender 130, which seats up to 8. To drive the Defender is to explore with greater confidence. Push what's possible with a vehicle made to go further. The Defender 110. Learn more at LandRoverUSA.com/Defender.
Collider says BritBox has TV everyone should be watching. Stream acclaimed series with powerful performances from Jodie Whittaker, Tamara Lawrence, Bella Ramsey, and Sophie Rundle. Discover new BritBox original series like Agatha Christie's Murder is Easy, BAFTA-winning drama Time, and new crime thriller After the Flood from the producers of Happy Valley. Stream what the New York Times calls the best of British telly. Only on BritBox. Start a free trial at BritBox.com.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
The living room is where you make life's most beautiful memories. But your sofa shouldn't be the one remembering them. The new life-resistant, high-performance furniture collection from Ashley is designed to withstand all the spills, slip-ups, and muddy paws that come with the best parts of life. Ashley high-performance sofas and recliners are soft, on-trend, and easy to clean. Shop the high-performance furniture in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.
Do it. And besides, if he did, I don't know how much of what he actually would say you could actually believe him anyway. So no, he did not say anything. He said a few things after the trial, and or maybe he'd make comments, some little comments to the media, but really he was quite silent other than the prolific writing of the letters that he did. And as I say, I do have those letters, and not sure those letters were never sent. All his letters to the politicians and for the appeals. So the question is, why did the justice system at that time, why did they not mail any of his letters? So that's another interesting point to consider with the fairness of maybe how he was treated.
Well, that's what I found interesting is that you say there's no real good reason for him seemingly to be prevented from sending out those letters. However, they did realize how much of a con man was and how convincing he was. And that might have been a good reason, especially considering that if they read that correspondence, that he was probably doing everything in his power to reach out to people in Ireland and London and everywhere else he could to appeal to these people. And I think at the time, like you say, I think the powers to be realized that there might be people that would interfere or delay this decision that they thought was very, very clear cut, and they didn't want
any
interference.
That's an excellent point. That's a really excellent point. And actually, I never thought about it in that way. And that's very, very possible. Just let it lie.
Yeah. Let's use this as an opportunity to stop for a second for these messages.
With the Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18+ terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Now, also in this case, the prosecution brought everybody up on that stand to, as they said, it was a circumstantial case, but these circumstances put together, there was no other inference to be made other than this George Stanley, John Kavanaugh, John Ryan was guilty of this heinous murder. But it was very interesting, and we've seen it before, but at this time in history, very interesting to see the defense, as you write, call no witnesses whatsoever.
Yeah, absolutely. And that was a very interesting tactic. I'm not sure if they probably couldn't find somebody who would speak on his behalf. Again, sometimes these types of cases were just kind of tossed to a particular lawyer. Here, you have to take this on. And it's not something like the defense really had anticipated having to do, or it's often given to a very, very junior lawyer, maybe who didn't have as much experience. But there's many times where they do make notes that here is this man alone in the wilderness in a foreign country with not a friend in sight. And I think that just goes to really back that statement up.
The idea that even at this trial, it's very, very fascinating. You talk about people commenting at this trial, hoots and clapping and commenting at this trial.
That's right. I mean, as I said before, like, this is a main form of entertainment at this time. People were really invested, and it's really no different today, where we're really involved in these cases and we have these judgments. We want to say our opinion and we're excited and we're just caught up in the moment as well. So I say we're exactly the same today. I have a fascination with true crime. I'm the same way. So, but people were definitely willing to give their opinions and to make sure justice was served in this case.
The one bright spot in this condemned person's life, as we mentioned in the introduction, this is a death penalty. He faced execution and he was sentenced to hang. But one respite in all of this was the jailer's daughter, Winifred. Tell us about this relationship that at least gave him some solace towards the end.
Yeah. So a lot of the records, when right before John gets hanged, there's a lot of records where he's thanking giving a lot of thanks to this Miss Smith. He mentions her quite frequently, this Miss Smith, and she comes to visit him in the jail and basically forms a relationship with him. She's just a young lady. And so this kind of gives him an outlet, a retreat, like just another person to listen to him. Or I feel like it's just his last chance of, you know, being his gregarious self and bringing people onto his side in whatever way he can. But he did definitely have some visits from somebody that he goes on to thank quite frequently. So yeah, you have to keep, I know there's a murder involved and is a heinous crime that he was convicted of, but we also need to keep in sight too, he was human too. He wasn't this monster killer. He was human.
You write about his background near the end of the book, not so much in the beginning, and you talk about what you found about his life in Ireland. Tell us about some of the background that you found.
Yeah. So again, my background is in psychology as well. So this is the part that really, really interests me. It's like, how did you become who you were? And when doing this research within Ireland, this is really what we discovered. So I think one of the big turning factors is that John's father dies when John is quite young. So his mother has three children that she needs to care for. Things are very tough financially. They have to move to another house. And so I think that plays a big role too. When that primary breadwinner passes away, it kind of creates a little bit more tension and a need to find a way to survive. Then what happened is I also found the mugshot, the police report for John as well. I have a copy of that is in our local museum. And on that, it outlines all of the different times that John was in prison. He was, as I said, he was in prison for probably 25 years of his life, not nonstop, but in and out, in and out, in and out. So I have all of those prison records. Now, if you examine these prison records from Ireland, what I take to note is that predominantly the crimes that he does, they're theft. And they usually happen around the end of October. And I think the first one is like he's convicted of stealing a coat. And maybe then, and the next fall, he's convicted of stealing trousers, some pants and things like that. So when I look at the record, what I'm noticing is that he is going to prison usually around the fall for stealing clothes. So that makes me wonder too, like, was he stealing because he's cold and he has nothing else? And that's kind of where I am. I feel like it was like a survival technique at the beginning. And they did have very harsh sentences, especially for theft like this. And of course, no social services opportunities at that time either, where he could get help or have a place to stay. So I feel like this kind of led to a life of crime. And then of course, you being in prison, you're in the prison life and surrounded maybe by bad influences as well, which I think just kind of escalated his crime. But he did start off stealing coats and clothes in the wintertime is how I see it. And that's kind of led to increased, and ultimately murder in Nova Scotia.
Let's talk about the run-up to the gallows and the media coverage and what his disposition is at the end.
Yeah, so the hanging does take place at the courthouse in the small town. They do it in the very wee hours of the morning so that nobody else will know the exact time. It's not published. They don't want big crowds coming. They don't want people to witness it. They want it to be very subdued and quiet. I think a lot of that was based upon, in my first novel, Two Crows, Sorrow, the hanging that had happened 2 years before in a town slightly close by, where it was such a debacle and things where it became a complete riot that I think the town here in Windsor did not want any of that to happen. So they really shut down the procedure and made it very quiet. So all throughout the time, you know, John is there and he's still not saying very much. You know, he's saying that he's innocent, but he's not protesting loudly or greatly. I feel like he just goes to the gallows in his quiet manner, and that is what happens. The media is reporting some of that information, and having been there and putting that news out about what happens. And then, of course, and then after that, it really sparked a big conversation in the area about capital punishment, about people not wanting this to happen and it not being a humane way to do within our justice system. So there was a lot of public backlash after the hanging. And I think because a lot of this, that was actually the last hanging that took place in that court system right there. John Kavanaugh, George Stanley was that last person.
Very, very interesting. What do you conclude in this book in terms of what you've learned from this and just sort of your take on this after completing this book and the research involved?
My thoughts about the murder and everything that happened?
Absolutely.
Absolutely, yeah. I went through, when I was writing it, as I said, my husband thought I really liked this character of John too much. And I feel I probably did. I mean, murder aside, everything that led to that moment, I kind of understood maybe where he was coming from. And so I was really conflicted about really what happened in terms of the murder and where he was and the mind frame around all of that. I was very conflicted. And why weren't these letters sent? And was he really trying to buy the farm? All of these were kind of open questions, but the more I thought about it afterwards and listening to other true crime podcasts about other people who are con people, I really feel that in the end, John really discovered that his lies were catching up to him. He hadn't bought the farm. He wasn't going to buy the farm, and he hadn't made any arrangements or agreements. And he promised the Fishers to be able to move into the house. So all of these lies were coming to a head. And I think he just kind of came to the breaking point of he realized he needed to do something about that. So, and I think that's, he just committed the murder to get the money and then to take off and then try to start a new life yet again in another area. So that I do really feel that that is what ultimately happened. There is a little bit of people wondering, oh, was it really Edgar McCarthy or the Fishers who really were involved? In the end, I really do think it was John who acted alone and just trying to, he just got himself in a mess that he couldn't get himself out of and couldn't see another way other than the murder.
It is extraordinary the people that he was able to convince of something oppositional to what really had occurred. He was a marvelous, conniving, and convincing criminal, I want to say.
Absolutely.
I want to thank you so much, Laura Churchill Duke, for coming on and talking about Rooted in Deception. For those people that might want to check out your other work, and do you have a website and do you do any social media? Tell us about that.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much. My website is laurachurchillduke.ca, and all of the information is about both of my books, Two Crows, Sorrow and Rooted Deception, are both on that. I'm also on Facebook under my name, Laura Churchill Duke, and then as an author. So that's the name of the page there, and I can be found there. And the books are all online as well through Amazon and Indigo and Barnes & Nobles and Walmart, just about everywhere that you can purchase books online, they are there as well.
Fantastic. Thank you. you so much, Laura Churchill Duke, Rooted in Deception. You have a great evening. Thank you so much for this interview.
Thank you so much.
Good night.
Collider says BritBox has TV everyone should be watching. Stream acclaimed series with powerful performances from Jodie Whittaker, Tamara Lawrence, Bella Ramsey, and Sophie Rundle. Discover new BritBox original series like Agatha Christie's Murder is Easy, BAFTA-winning drama Time, and new crime thriller After the Flood from the producers of Happy Valley. Stream what the New York Times calls the best of British telly. Only on BritBox. Start a free trial at BritBox.com.